And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io.
And we're back for another episode of the Startup Hustle. This is Matt Watson. Very excited to be joined today by Rob Snyder, the founder and CEO of Reframe. Today we're going to talk a lot about product market fit. We're going to talk about how he spent a lot of money going to Harvard, and I think it was a waste of time compared to working in startups, and what it's really like to be an entrepreneur. So it should be a fun conversation today. I do want to remind you that today's episode is brought to you by Fullscale, which is my company. We do software development for other startups and scale-ups. We have 300 employees. Check us out at fullscale.io. I also want to remind everybody that we are on YouTube. You can find Startup Hustle on YouTube. This episode will be there. We also have a newsletter. You can check out the newsletter at startuphustle.xyz. That's the domain name, .xyz, and click on newsletter. Rob, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you, Matt. Excited to be here.
So, you know, I think one of the biggest mysteries and challenges for a lot of companies is product market fit. I would love for you to first just tell us, what in the world does that even mean?
Yeah, so I actually ask that a lot, and there's like a million different definitions for product market fit that people have. It's usually something along the lines of somebody wants your product, or you've made something people want. I tend to think about product market fit as you're able to repeat a customer case study. And I think that simplifies everything a lot. It's basically, we can take a customer from not knowing who we are to successful with us, and we can just repeat that a lot. And over time, that customer pulls a lot more than we push through the process. If you think about it like that, it gets a lot simpler than kind of like these esoteric theories.
Well, and I think it's when you talk to a customer and you explain the problem you're trying to solve and how you solve it, it resonates really well with them, right? They're like, okay, I get it. I would actually buy that thing. I would actually use that thing. But I think one of the hardest things is when you're an early stage startup, almost everybody tells you they like whatever your idea is, right? You call your friend, your uncle, your old college roommate, whatever, and they're like, yeah, man, that's a great idea. You should build that thing. Yeah, but that is not product market fit.
Right. No. It's really only product market fit when they give you money and when they keep
giving you money. Wait a second. Startups don't make money. No. What are you talking about?
No. Yeah, no, you're supposed to just raise on hype and then eventually I think you just IPO with zero in revenue, right? Is that how it works?
I had somebody on the podcast that did that. It was publicly traded, had raised $500 million and had zero revenue. Publicly traded.
Amazing.
It was on this podcast.
That is amazing. There's a lottery ticket approach here, which is fine. Like, if you want to play the lottery, cool. I just kind of want to build a real business and want to build one that grows fast and that serves customers. And so at some point, someone's got to pay for something. Like, otherwise, this isn't capitalism. This is just weird.
So tell us about Reframe and what you guys do. Do you work as consultants to help people figure out product market fit? Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so we run a program for founders, basically. So we get a lot of companies that come out of YC, they've raised a lot, but they're hitting their head against the wall trying to find product market fit, find repeatability. And so I guess like the context is when I came out of business school and spent the next 2 years hitting my head against the wall trying to find product market fit, I always felt like there wasn't a clear way to think about it, a clear way to approach it, frameworks that were actually useful, practices that were actually useful. And so when we did find product market fit, we realized that it was a lot simpler and dumber kind of than we had ever thought it was. And so we kind of bundled all of that into a very fast program. Like, it has been 3 weeks. It's now going to be 5 weeks. Bring 20 to 40 startups in, and run them through that to make as much progress as humanly possible in that short amount of time. And we find that like a couple of things actually matter. One is just like, what's the velocity at which you can talk with customers? If you can talk to a lot of customers really fast, you can learn really fast. The second is like, can you get a lot of reps watching other people talk to customers and figuring out, okay, how do we critique their pitch? And wait a second, I made that critique of their pitch. Now I need to make that critique of my own pitch. Like getting a lot of reps on both of those things is probably the best and fastest way to like get out of theory land, get out of selling the product you wish people wanted, and like get to the point of, okay, we're actually selling the product that people want.
So the class that you do, is that a like a virtual sort of Zoom thing that people go to like every day for an hour, or like how does that actually?
So it's 5 weeks Zoom. We might do a meetup at some point, but it's all been Zoom. I'm out in the woods of New Hampshire, so no one in the startup world is out here. And it's a weekly thing where every week we meet three times for 30 to 90 minutes per time, depending on what we're doing.
Okay. Like,
and there's office hours, there's an assignment every week that is very much in line with something you actually need to do for your business. So pull together your sales pitch, and we rapid fire review sales pitches, rapid fire reviews, even call sales call recordings. It's just what we found like helps people make the most progress the fastest.
So when you're helping people go through this, how often is the issue the product or product features, or is it usually more just who you're selling to and how you're selling it?
It is almost always the latter. Basically always. So the problem generally takes the shape of, we can't even describe what we do in a way that makes sense to target customers.
Yeah.
So they just like, they don't even have the chance to find product market fit. They speak, it's like coming on a call and speaking Hungarian, right? Like it just doesn't resonate. And so what we have to do is we have to find ways to like take what's in your mind of what your product does and translate it into a language that your customers can actually understand. And then you can iterate and figure out, okay, what are they actually trying to achieve? What I tend to see though is that when trying to do that, there are quite a few challenges that startups run into. Like one is, we're trying to serve multiple theoretical customer segments. And so when we try to make that translation to like what we want to sell to what they want to buy, it's just like super ambiguous. And then there's a bunch of other ones where it's like, oh, well, I want to like, here's my vision for how the world should work. Let me try to translate that to your world. And like, no one cares. They just have stuff to do in their lives. They like have to accomplish stuff. They have projects and goals for work. And so your customers like just won't understand that. They won't care. And so a lot of the challenges that we deal with are like, how do we translate from our product to like what people want to buy?
Well, it's usually their problems, right? It's reframing it primarily in the problems that relate to them on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, their problems, their goals, what projects they have, all that kind of stuff. Like starting from the point of not here's the product, but here's what you're trying to accomplish. Does this resonate with you? Like is a lot better of a starting point than here's why we're the best in the world.
Well, and how often do you run into it where entrepreneurs are just trying to do too many things or trying to serve too many different verticals or types of customers? And so they have a message that doesn't resonate with anybody because they're trying to resonate with everybody, right?
Yes.
Like, and I've been guilty of this myself, where it's like, if I had done this simpler thing for one persona, that one persona would have understood it every time. They would have understood the problem every time. But instead, I'm trying to sell everything to everyone, and nobody gets it.
Yeah, I think even more narrow than that. Even when you think of personas, I find when you think of a persona, for some reason, startups tend to just like talk like corporates. And so what I've found is really effective is don't even get to the persona level, just find one customer and resonate really, really deeply with them. And then try to repeat that with another customer that looks almost identical to them. And then the persona will emerge in time. But when you're going from 0 to 10 customers, just like focus N equals 1 and you can actually resonate with one person versus when you talk at the persona level, it's even hard then with just one persona too.
So you find this one person, let's call them the purple squirrel,
yes,
that loves your product. Then how do you go find 10 more purple squirrels? Like, I feel like that's still a challenge.
Totally. Yeah, yeah. None of this is easy. This all hurts. what I've found though is the way to think about this is you find one customer, get them to say hell yes before they buy, and hopefully also after they buy. And then what you do is you use that one customer story and use that as your sales process for other customers. You show that sales, that customer story, and you're like, this is what this person was trying to accomplish. They seem like you, but how are you different? And if you just center it on this customer success story, then the conversation gets a lot easier. People can disqualify if they're trying to accomplish something way different. And it says, okay, they were trying to accomplish this. With us, they accomplished this. And here's what results look like. And here was the path there. Then that customer looks, or the prospective customer can look at that story and say, yeah, that's exactly what I want to accomplish, exactly how I want to accomplish it. Great. And you're set up not only to like repeat the sales process, but also to repeat the success process of how do we get them successful. And I find that is like thinking of it as an end-to-end customer success story that you're trying to repeat is the most effective way to go from one customer to 10 customers. And then as you repeat it, you kind of debug the success story so it resonates with more and more people. And it's a lot simpler than trying to go and say, okay, here's this massive market we want to serve. In theory, here are all the problems they might have, and trying to resonate with all of them.
So you're saying focus on the case study, and then in your sales approach, reference the case study. This is the problem. This is the person I helped, and the problem we helped them solve. And you're also using that as third party proof at the same time.
Totally. Yeah, it just makes everything a lot. It feels like you are sitting on the same side of the table as your prospective customer, and you're looking at the case study and saying, like, you're looking at it together versus you sitting on the opposite side of the table as your prospective customer and trying to sell to them, right? It's got a totally different feel to the conversation.
So then I think, so I love this. I think it's a great idea. We just did a bunch of case studies at Full Scale, and was awesome to do the case studies and hear everybody rave about, you know, all the things, all the stuff. So case studies are awesome, but then still with the struggle of like, okay, how do I find more people who are going to want our service? Like how do we scale past that, right? How do I find the next 10 purple squirrels? I feel like it's still part of the challenge.
Totally. Yeah. There are two kinds of businesses. One where pipeline isn't the problem, which is great. And then everyone else where pipeline is the number one problem. And so, yeah, what I've seen early on is that startups try to do like too many difficult things to find their first 10 customers. That's based, like, if you're trying to do cold outbound, scale cold outbound like Ramp does, or one of these big unicorn companies that's got hundreds of millions of dollars in the bank, like, yeah, you're not going to succeed. What I find works really well early on is warm intros to your first 10 customers, using your network, building a customer advisory board, basically like not trying to quote unquote scale this. All that matters when you're at one customer is getting to your second customer. All that matters of two customers is getting to three. And so when you think in that way, it's like, okay, how do I just have 5 conversations per week with target customers? Okay, I'll just send a couple LinkedIn messages per day, and like that'll work. And I'll pitch it, you know, I won't pitch the product necessarily. I'll just say, hey, I'm working on this really interesting thing. Would you be open to talking? And you can use founder magic for your first 10, 20 customers. And then in time, you figure out what is the exact pitch that can land cold on somebody and like cause them to want to talk to you. But I try not to solve that very, very difficult problem super early on.
But I feel like most companies, if they're doing the things you're mentioning, so in summary, you talk about, okay, getting the messaging right, focusing on what the product should do, case studies, dealing with warm leads, doing the hard work. Like, it's hard work doing this one-on-one, you know, finding people. A lot of people can have success in the very early stage, but then at some point in time, that kind of runs out, right? Like, you kind of hit this, you know, trough of disillusionment, or the chasm, or whatever people want to call these things, where it's like, hey, you can get through the first part of that. And then you're like, I don't know how to scale past that. Like, I don't know how to get to the next level. How to build like a growth engine that really grows and scales and takes it outside of my little network or my city or whatever. So do you help people with that part of it too? Or you're focused kind of more on the first part of it?
I am more focused on the first part of it. Now, I've taken a bunch of companies to their first million ARR. And so like that process, it tends to look like, okay, first 10, 20 customers are like network. And really the point of those first 10 to 20 customers is to figure out what is that one hell yes case study that we can repeat, and really deeply understanding what causes the customer to like need to accomplish something at all. Why do they need to change in the first place? And what makes our product relevant in their lives? And usually by understanding what the hell yes case study is and why they need to change, you know the leverage points on where can you actually build a growth engine. So like, for example, one of the companies that I work with is called MookTest. They do QA automation. And what they realized in their first 20 customers was that there are a couple of key signals that say, okay, this company actually needs to invest in QA. Before that, they couldn't have built a growth engine because they just wouldn't have known where to intervene. Now they know, okay, I should target companies when XYZ happens. And here's the approach that we should target. And there's 100 companies that are like this every week. And so let's go all in on that. Let's build an outbound system around that. But that is something that I think emerges through the process of figuring out what your case study is and why people need to change in the first place and who says hell yes. It's not something that you can like logic your way into.
But I think when companies hit true product market fit a little, you know, in their later stage, that's where that flywheel gets really, really, really going. That's when you know you've truly hit product market fit, though, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. We had in my company, we had like 60% of customers coming through word of mouth referrals. Like, I would get calls from people who wanted to be customers who said, I've heard of you. I need to buy it. How do I sign up? Where do I pay? And also, what exactly do you do? And like, it was questions in that order. And
take
like,
my okay. money.
Yeah, yeah. Like, that's where you want to get to.
100%. Well, if you need help with building software, you can check us out at Full Scale. Hopefully that's your problem. You need to scale up your development team. Yeah. You can check us out at fullscale.io. Front end, back end, mobile, QA, all the tech stacks, all the things. We can help you. Check us out at Full Scale. So you went to Harvard for a couple of years. What led you to go to Harvard? Well, you're like, you wake up one day, you're like, I want to spend a shit ton of money and I want to go to Harvard. Why did you decide to go to Harvard?
Yeah, so honestly, I got in when I was in undergrad. So I went to undergrad at the University of Pittsburgh. Harvard Business School, their MBA program, has this thing called the 2+2 program, which is get accepted when you're an undergrad, go work, get some real world work experience for 2 years, and then come here. And so I was a junior in college with zero work experience and was just like, you know what? Screw it. Like, I'll apply to this. There's no chance that I'm going to get in. Then I got in. I was like, okay, well, that's strange. Now I need to get a job for 2 years. Had no idea what job I wanted to get. So I Googled like, what jobs do people do before they go to business school? It's like, consultant. Great. And so I went and got a job at McKinsey and worked at McKinsey for 2 years. And in the process there, it was like, okay, I don't like this. This is not for me. I want to build. And there was like all this stuff around startups. I kind of like interned at a startup or two. And I was like, okay, I really, really like this. And so I just assumed, okay, you're going to like the West Point of capitalism. Why not go and like learn how to build a startup? And so I focused my entire time at HBS on like, how do I build a startup? How do I get a startup off the ground?
So when you went to Harvard, was that on site on campus or was that all virtual?
No, it was on site. On site.
Okay. So what would you say that they taught you at Harvard and how that related to the real startup world?
Yeah, I think I loved my experience at Harvard. I absolutely loved it. Met great people. The quality of the education was great. On the startup side, what I found was that they taught you a lot of theories around perhaps scaling and leading a startup.
Okay.
But the frameworks and approaches for like, how do you get from zero to one were like not super helpful. It was like, find a problem. Okay. Yeah. Cool. Build a solution. Do that fast. Your typical like, lean startup stuff. Yeah. So basically it's step one, get an idea. Step two, find product market fit. Step three, scale. And here's how you scale, right? Which is, you know, when you're at zero looking forward and you're like, wait a second, what the hell do I do today? Like it wasn't super helpful.
So it's more about running a company that has 50, 100, 200, 500 employees and how to run that kind of business. Is that really what they focused more on?
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. It's like, there are really good classes on like, how do you manage yourself as a founder? How do you manage the stress of being a founder? Which I think is like very, very helpful. How do you manage the ups and downs? A lot of courses on how do you think like a VC, which is very helpful if you're going to be a VC and the opposite of helpful if you're going to be a startup founder. But yeah, like there wasn't a ton on how do you navigate zero to one. And I just find like that's actually kind of the case everywhere. I don't think it's like necessarily just a Harvard thing. Like I think there's books and stuff out there, there's frameworks out there, but most of them are counterproductive and like simplistic at a level that is unhelpful, kind of steers you straight into the iceberg as a founder.
Well, it all sounds simple, right? You're like, you identify a problem and you're like, I think most founders, I did this twice recently, actually in the last 6 months. I'm like, okay, I'm trying to figure out how to do something. I can't find anybody who can do this thing. I figure out how to do it. I figure out how to solve it. And now I'm like, is there a market for this thing? Why sell this to somebody else? Am I going to start a business solving this problem, right? Whatever the problem is. Like for a friend of mine that I had on the podcast, he's like, I'm trying to build custom outdoor cabinets and nobody sells custom outdoor cabinets. So do I start a business selling custom outdoor cabinets because nobody else does it, right? Like usually that's how the ideas start. They usually start something like that, right? Like find a problem. But then you're like, how do I actually build this thing? How do I build custom outdoor cabinets? How would I build a website to design custom outdoor? And the plethora of actually how to accomplish all that is like its own like American Ninja Warrior course.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what happens, so that is what you just laid out is like the ideal scenario of like, I encounter a problem and I'm like, oh wow, there really isn't anything else out here to solve this. The like, more often scenario is I want to build a startup. Let me find an idea, which is like that leads to a totally different pain cave. But what happens no matter what is you're like, okay, I have this idea. I have this problem that I think now there's a million things I could theoretically do. And what the hell do I do today? How do I start? Where do I go from here? And and just what I find is that breaks smart founders' brains. There's so many things that could theoretically be important. You want to validate things. You want to quickly find product market fit. You want to build the product, but you don't have full conviction that there's a market there. And figuring out like where to focus is so important. And my sense is that we do way too much theorizing, over intellectualizing. It's like way simpler and dumber than you think it needs. Like than you think it should be. Like it's, you know, can I just go find customer one? And based on that, can I learn enough to get to customer two? I don't need a website. Like I got to get to a million ARR with no website, with no customer login in our software, with nothing, right? It was just 100K ARR was me in a Google spreadsheet. A million ARR was like customers receiving reports by email, all direct outbound, all with four slides, like a four slide sales deck. you need way less than you think you do, and you learn everything you need to know in the process of selling to customer one, then two, then three, right? It just kind of all unfolds. It's just really hard to like get there from the theory side of things when there's so many things you could possibly focus on, so many different ways the business could take shape.
Well, it seems like in the early stage, it's either one or two problems. It's they don't know how to build a product, or they're not building the right product. You know, they don't know how to build software, right? Or they don't have the money to build software, or they don't want to find a business partner, you know, a tech founder, CTO, whatever, to help them build a product. So it's usually on the product side, or it's what we talked about earlier with product market fit. Like, they don't know how to sell it. They don't know how to message it. They think that they need more product. They don't necessarily need more product anymore. They already built the product. They figured that part out. Good. But now they're still focused on like thinking they need more product instead of selling what they already built, because they're overcomplicating it potentially. Well, what if they need this thing? What if they need that thing? We need to add this thing, right? So it seems like everybody gets lost there somewhere.
Yes. Yeah. And like every customer who doesn't buy, or every word a customer says on a sales demo, right, it's like, oh, I need to build something different. I need to build something more. And like, that's almost never the case. It is almost never the case. If you actually understand what customers are trying to accomplish, you can offer them something that helps them get there. What more often happens is you show them product in a sales demo and they don't understand it. They just throw out a bunch of random pieces of feedback and you take that as your product roadmap, and then you bring it back to them and they still don't want it. And like, that is the failure pattern that I see most often is we talk to customers, we show them our product. They say things to us because it would be awkward if they didn't, and they have no intention to really buy, or they say, oh yeah, it would be theoretically interesting if you did XYZ. And you know, that's just the path to pain, and you can spend years there.
You know, what's interesting there, you say both, like, you have to listen to your customer, and at the same time, don't listen to the customer. It's both.
Yeah, right? Totally. There's that old quote of like listen to the customer's problems, don't listen to what they think the solutions should be. The way I think of it is like, all of this gets so much easier if you just put everything in the context of a customer case study or a customer success story. If you show the customer success story, everything downstream gets simpler, because if the customer says, yeah, I don't want to accomplish that, then their feedback is irrelevant. You can just stop it there, and you don't go and build something for 6 months. But if they're like, oh yeah, I do want to accomplish that, but the shape of what I want to accomplish is a little different, it's like, okay, cool. Then maybe their feedback is relevant. Maybe we're just messaging this wrong. And it's so much easier to change a sales deck than it is to change a product. And so that's where I always try to start, is sales deck around a customer success story. Show it to them and say, where are you different? And when you hear things from them, decide, okay, do we have the wrong success story? Is this the wrong person? Before you go out and spend 6 months building.
I really like how you frame this up with, you want to listen to their problem. You don't want to necessarily listen to their solution, because a lot of people have no concept of how to build software. And somebody pointed this out the other day on X, formerly known as Twitter, that Elon Musk is trying to spend all this time building autonomous cars, all this stuff. And they're like, or you could just get a horse. We could just ride horses and they work pretty well autonomously. But we overcomplicate everything to the nth degree, right? We'll spend like billions of dollars trying to replace a horse.
Yes. Yeah. It's interesting. Like, how deep of a rabbit hole you can go down. You can go down a like decade long rabbit hole if you have enough money to do that. Building the wrong product for a variety of reasons, because it's what you think customers want, because it's what your vision tells you to build, because you got some random feedback from an investor. It's like, just avoid the pain cave. Just like, frame everything as a customer success story. Repeat that. Just try to repeat that and debug it. And like, there'd be just like so much better products in the world. There'd be so many fewer like burnt out entrepreneurs if we just did that. Just a lot simpler.
Well, I'm glad we're having this conversation because I have a couple different startup like product ideas that we're incubating internally. And one of the things I need to do next is reach out to some other people. And it's like, hey, do you also have this problem? Like, that's literally what I need to do. It's like, I have this problem. Do you have this problem? I think I figured out a way to solve it. Does this make any sense to you? And that might be my weekend. So I might be messaging you and be like, hey, Rob, you have this problem.
Yeah, please do. And like frame it as, hey, I was trying to do this thing. I couldn't accomplish it. I looked at these different options and like nothing else worked. And so I did this and this worked. Does this resonate with you at all? And I'll be able to say, oh, like that story meets me where I am. And I can say, oh, no, I've never tried to accomplish that thing. Or hell yeah, I tried to accomplish that. And I used this other option that you weren't considering, right? And that helps you put context into the customer story so that, you know, you can pitch better or you can say, actually, this isn't a thing.
So after you finish your degree at Harvard, did you immediately go to the corporate world or did you go start a company or what did you do after you finished at Harvard?
Raised just over $1 million for a pre-seed round 2 weeks after graduating.
Okay.
And then
you had to unlearn everything you learned to actually make the business run or?
Yeah.
How did that go?
Yeah. Basically raised $1.2 million. We had pilot customers using the product. We had a massive vision. We had a roadmap. We knew exactly, going to disrupt an $80 billion industry. And then like reality just kind of punched me in the face for 2 years while I tried to make it happen. And that was basically the point where I unlearned most of what I had thought I knew about how to build a startup. So we did that for 2 years through a variety of pivots, I think like five or six different pivots. And just found that we couldn't resonate with our end customers, that they would like nod and say, oh yeah, in theory, this sounds great, but they wouldn't take action. And we just couldn't really figure anything out that customers would actually buy and take action on. And went down a variety of rabbit holes and it was just kind of like awful. And then we did a Hail Mary pivot 2 years in because one customer called us and said, you know what? I don't want to buy what you have. I need to accomplish this. You're a tech nerd. Can you help me? And I was like, all right, cool, fine. I got nothing else going. I'll give it a swing. And like did it for them, helped them. It wound up being like helping them recruit hourly workers from among their like past applicants and former employees. And yeah, it was just like, I just did that in a spreadsheet and like my phone texting them. And that, then we sold that to another customer and we're like, wait, actually maybe there's something here. And it was like way easier to sell than everything we had tried before. And it just kind of started snowballing and like it basically, so it took 2 years of getting punched in the face and then like a year of like basically having no plan and things just kind of falling into place and things just emerging from hitting our heads against different walls. And like, that's finally when I realized that, oh, wait a second, there's like a way simpler way to approach this early stage thing and finding product market fit that is, yeah, it's a lot more intuitive. It requires me to know a lot less at the outset. And it just, you know, it actually works.
So looking back, in your very first company, you struggled, you did all these pivots. I mean, looking back, do you think that could have been successful knowing what you know today? Or was it just the wrong idea to begin with?
No business has emerged in that space. So I think it was probably just the wrong idea to begin with.
Okay.
That said, right, you always start with the wrong idea in some way, and it just takes reality to like get you to the right idea. And so as a starting point, I don't think it was necessarily a totally dumb starting point. I just think that if I had been less wedded to building this particular company with this particular product, like I could have saved probably 2 years of pain, maybe a year and a half of pain by just figuring out, okay, this is the starting point. Let me show this to customers and they kind of like yawn and say, okay, what are they actually trying to buy? What are they actually trying to accomplish? And redesign everything around that. Like instead of 2 years, I could have done that in like 3 months.
So now that you've mastered product market fit and trying to, you know, getting things off the ground, do you feel like your degree from Harvard has been super helpful to you?
Someone once said, like, the Harvard degree increases the slope of your career, which is not always visible in your first 5-10 years. So I'm six years out now. And I would say, like, there are a lot of things from the degree that have been wildly valuable. The network is awesome. The, you know, it's awesome to be able to like wear this Harvard shirt, right? Like, and a lot of the things that I learned outside of entrepreneurship, I think have been like very helpful. Thinking about leadership, learning finance. I didn't know finance at all, right? So the like general management skills were awesome. But yeah, like the entrepreneurship stuff, I think it was directionally helpful post product market fit. Pre product market fit, a different approach is needed.
Do you think it helped you tremendously when you went to raise that $1 million you mentioned?
Oh, 100%.
Being a Harvard grad?
100%. Yeah. Like, absolutely.
So what's next for you? What are you going to do next? Are you going to just continue to run this product market fit, you know, kind of coaching boot camp? I'm not sure how you would describe it, but is that your focus or what's next for you?
Yeah. So the product market fit program that I'm running is like, it's something that I really enjoy putting my soul into and like helping founders navigate this stage. And so I want to keep doing that. I don't want it to, like, I'm not trying to scale it. I'm not trying to build some crazy big thing. I feel like it just, like, needs a kind of small curated approach. And then I'm going to keep launching startups. Like, I just like building new things. And so I'm working on a startup in the compliance space. And, yeah, I don't know. I've got the bug. I don't think I can work for anybody else. I feel like I'm officially unemployable at this stage. And so I've got to keep working for myself.
You're officially an entrepreneur then.
Officially.
You know, so like you, I also have entrepreneurial ADHD. As I described, I have a couple other business ideas that we're incubating. And I think it's a little bit of a curse for me because I'm a product guy. You know, I'm a software developer at heart. I'm a product guy at heart. Like, I like to build products. So I see problems like I could solve that problem. So I like want to go build something. So it's like a never ending like disease that you get as an entrepreneur, especially I think if you're very problem focused, product focused.
Totally. Yeah. I have like a backlog of things that I like desperately want to build from like outdoor gyms, like not even software. Like I just think there should be more outdoor gyms in the world to a bunch of software products that I'd like to build someday. Fortunately or unfortunately, I'm not technical, which means like, I can't just go off and go down a rabbit hole for a couple months and build something I like. And so the only way I can be useful in a startup is talking to as many customers as possible. And I think that keeps me grounded. But yeah, I like would love to launch a bunch of things in the future. But what I found, I don't know if you've found this, is I can really only focus on one at a time. Like getting something from zero to one is really, really hard and requires pretty much singular obsession. And so, at least for me. And so I have a million things I want to do, but I can only get Reframe off the ground. And then I can only get this next product off the ground. And like, I don't think I can do like three at once.
You have to have the right team that you can delegate stuff to and trust is the only way to do it.
Yeah. That checks out.
The the other thing that I've really learned is it's so much easier to grow something than it is to create something. Like, yeah. like we've talked about, right? Getting zero to one is insanely hard. And you take a company like Fullscale, for an example, for us to add $1 million in annual revenue, it's hard, but it's not like a crazy lift, right? We have 300 employees, adding another 10, 20, 30 employees, whatever, adding $1 million. Like, sure, we can do that. So then it's like, it'd be way easier to add $1 million in revenue at Fullscale than like, I'm going to go start this new thing at zero and get it to $1 million. Like, oh my God, that seems like a daunting task. So I guess after doing this for 25 years now, I'm like, I'd rather grow something than start something also.
Yeah, I think it does take a special kind of stupid to want to start something new after you've been through that a couple of times. Like, and then like the worst part is when you get to one, right? Like then other people come in and they look at what you've done and they're like, they offer some just stupidly obvious ideas of how you should get from one to 10 that you haven't right. considered because you've been hitting your head against the wall. And you're like, all right, it took me this long and this much pain to get from zero to one. And I didn't even think of these obvious things. So you just kind of feel stupid the whole way from zero to one. So yeah, like way better for your sanity to like go from 10 to 100 than from zero to one repeatedly.
But it's so much fun to build something new.
The promise.
So it's a disease, man. You have the disease.
The promise. I know.
Well, I really appreciate having you on the show today. Again, this was Rob Snyder with Reframe, which is reframeb2b.com. Check out his class and program around product market fit, which sounds extremely helpful. I think most founders, especially first-time founders, really, really struggle with this. Even after doing this a few times, I could probably use this. Mm-hmm. So anything more you can add to that about what it costs or any of that you want to share?
Yeah, so it's a program, costs a couple $1,000 to join for a 5-week program where you get a ton of feedback, get all your calls reviewed, like all that kind of stuff. So we're trying to keep it relatively accessible. There's a limited amount of seats per cohort. It runs once a quarter. And yeah, you can apply, join the wait list for the next one, launches in July, and launch every quarter after that.
All right. Sounds super helpful. All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. Everybody that's listening, please check out our newsletter at startuphustle.xyz. Check us out on YouTube. Leave us a great 5-star review. Thank you so much. And see you on the next episode. Thank you, guys.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. We do it like we do it.